1960, sitting in the sun, I open the well-remembered first volume, printed in 1883. I turn to number one of the Spectator, Thursday, March 1, 1711. It was headed,
Non fumum ex fulgore, sed ex fumo dare lucem cogit, et speciosa de hinc miracula promat.
Horace. I remember so well loving Addison's use of capital letters for nouns. He writes under this date, I have observed that a reader seldom peruses a book with pleasure till he knows whether the writer of it be a black or fair man, of a mild or choleric disposition, married or a bachelor, with other particulars of the like nature that conduce very much to the right understanding of an author. To gratify this curiosity, which is so natural to a reader, I design this paper and my next as prefatory discourses to my following writings, and shall give some account in them of the several persons that are engaged in this work. As the chief trouble of compiling, digesting, and correcting will fall to my share, I must do myself the justice to open the work with my own history. Sunday, January 29th, 1961. Yes, Joseph Addison, I hear and I will obey within reason, for it appears that the curiosity you speak of has in no way abated. I have found many readers more interested in what I wear than in what I think, more avid to know how I do it than in what I do. In regarding my work, some readers profess greater feeling for what it makes than for what it says. Since a suggestion from the master is a command not unlike holy writ, I shall digress and comply at the same time. Among the generality of men, I am tall, 6 feet even, although among the males of my family I'm considered a dwarf. They range from 6 feet 2 inches to 6 feet 5. And I know that both my sons, when they stretch their full height, will overtop me. I'm very wide of shoulder and, in the condition I now find myself, narrow of hip. My legs are long in proportion to my trunk and are said to be shapely. My hair is a grizzled gray, my eyes blue, and my cheeks ruddy, a complexion inherited from my Irish mother. My face has not ignored the passage of time, but recorded it with scars, lines, furrows, and erosions. I wear a beard and a mustache, but shave my cheeks. Said beard, having a dark skunk strip up the middle and white edges, commemorates certain relatives. I cultivate this beard not for the usual given reasons of skin trouble or pain of shaving, nor for the secret purpose of covering a weak chin, but as pure, unblushing decoration, much as a peacock finds pleasure in his tail. And finally, in our time, a beard is the one thing a woman cannot do better than a man, or if she can, her success is assured only in a circus. My costume for traveling was utilitarian, if a trifle bizarre. Half Wellington rubber boots with cork inner soles kept my feet warm and dry. Khaki cotton trousers, bought in an army surplus store, covered my shanks, while my upper regions rejoiced in a hunting coat with corduroy cuffs and collar and a game pocket in the rear big enough to smuggle an Indian princess into a YMCA. My cap was one I have worn for many years, a blue serge British naval cap with a short visor and on its peak the royal lion and unicorn, as always fighting for the crown of England. This cap is pretty ratty and salt-crusted, but it was given me by the skipper of a motor torpedo boat on which I sailed out of Dover during the war. A gentle gentleman and a murderer. After I left his command, he attacked a German E-boat and held his fire trying to take it whole since none had ever been captured, and in the process he got himself sunk. I have worn his cap ever since in his honor and in his memory. Besides, I like it. It agrees with me. Down east, this cap did not draw a second glance, but when later, in Wisconsin, North Dakota, Montana, I had left the sea far behind, I thought it drew attention, and I bought what we used to call a stockman's hat, a Stetson. Not too wide a brim, a rich but conservative western hat of the kind my cow-harrying uncles used to wear. Only when I came down to another sea in Seattle did I reassume the naval cap. Thus far with Addison's injunction, but my reader has me back in that New Hampshire picnic place. As I sat there, fingering the first volume of The Spectator and considering how the mind usually does two things at once that it knows about and probably several it doesn't, a luxurious car drove in, and a rather stout and bedizened woman released a rather stout and bedizened Pomeranian of the female persuasion. I would not have known this latter fact, but Charlie knew. Emerging from behind the garbage can, he found her beautiful. His French blood flared up, and he proceeded to gallantries unmistakable even to the slack eyes of Mademoiselle's mistress. This creature let out a shriek like a wounded rabbit, emerged from the car with an explosive ooze, and would have snatched her darling to her bosom if she could have bent down that far. The best she could do was to fetch a slap at tall Charlie's head. He quite naturally and casually took a nip at her hand before proceeding toward romance. Until that moment, I never quite knew the meaning of the phrase, to make the welkin ring. In the first place, I didn't know what a welkin was. I looked it up later, and that bull bitch of a woman sure as hell made it ring. I grabbed her hand and saw that the skin wasn't even broken, so I grabbed her dog, which promptly bit me good and drew blood before I could get the little monster by the throat and gently throttle it. Charlie regarded the whole scene as nonsense. He went on the garbage can for the 20th time and called it a day. It took time to calm the lady. I brought out the bottle of brandy, which might have killed her, and she took a slug that should have killed her. After all I've done for him, you think Charlie would have come to my aid, but he dislikes neurotics and he detests drunks. He climbed in Rosinante, crawled under the table, and went to sleep. Sic semper cum frogs. At last, m'lady flailed away with her handbrake on, and the kind of a day I had built lay in ruins. Addison had crashed in flames, the trout no longer ringed the pool, and a cloud covered the sun and put a chill in the air. I found myself driving faster than I wanted to, and it began to rain, a cold steel rain. I didn't give the lovely villages the attention they deserved, and before long I had crossed into Maine and continued eastward. I wish any two states could get together on a speed limit. Just about the time you get used to 50 miles an hour, you cross the state line and it's 65. I wonder why they can't settle down and agree. However, in one matter all states agree. Each one admits it is the finest of all and announces the fact in huge letters as you cross the state line. Among nearly 40, I didn't see a single state that hadn't a good word to say for itself. It seemed a little indelicate. It might be better to let visitors find out for themselves. But maybe we wouldn't if it weren't drawn to our attention. Preparation for the winter in New England is drastic. The summer population must be large, and the roads and highways gorge with refugees from the sticky heat of Boston and New York. Now the hot dog stands, the ice cream parlors, the curiosity shops, deerskin, moccasin, and glove places were all shuttered and closed, many of them with the cards saying, "Open next summer." I can never get used to the thousands of antique shops along the roads, all bulging with authentic and attested trash from an earlier time. I believe the population of the 13 colonies was less than 4 million souls, and every one of them must have been frantically turning out tables, chairs, china, glass, candle molds, and oddly shaped bits of iron, copper, and brass for future sale to 20th century tourists. There are enough antiques for sale along the roads of New England alone to furnish the houses of a population of 50 million. If I were a good businessman and cared a tittle for my unborn great-grandchildren, which I do not, I would gather all the junk and the wrecked automobiles, comb the city dumps, and pile these gleanings in mountains and spray the whole thing with the stuff the Navy uses to mothball ships. At the end of 100 years, my descendants would be permitted to open this treasure trove and would be the antique kings of the world. If the battered, cracked, and broken stuff our ancestors tried to get rid of now brings so much money, think what a 1954 Oldsmobile or a 1960 Toastmaster will bring. And a vintage wearing mixer. Lord, the possibilities are endless. Things we have to pay to have hauled away could bring fortunes. If I seem to be overinterested in junk, it is because I am, and I have a lot of it, too. Half a garage full of bits and broken pieces. I use things for repairing other things. Recently, I stopped my car in front of the display yard of a junk dealer near Sag Harbor. As I was looking courteously at the stock, it suddenly occurred to me that I had more than he had. But it can be seen that I do have a genuine and almost miserly interest in worthless objects. My excuse is that in this era of planned obsolescence, when a thing breaks down, I can usually find something in my collection to repair it. A toilet, or a motor, or a lawnmower. But I guess the truth is that I simply like junk. Before I started my tour, I had known that at intervals of every few days I would have to stop at auto courts or motels, not so much to sleep, but for the sake of hot, luxurious bathing. In Rocinante, I heated water in a tea kettle and took sponge baths, but bathing in a bucket delivers little cleanliness and no pleasure whatever. A deep dish sit down in a tub with scalding water is a pure joy. Quite early on my trip, however, I invented a method for washing clothes, which you will go a long way to better. It came about this way. I had a large plastic garbage bucket with cover and bail. Since the normal movement of the truck tipped it over, I tethered it by a length of strong elastic rope of cotton-covered rubber to the clothes pole in my little closet, where it could jiggle to its heart's content without spilling. After a day of this, I opened it to dispose of the stuff at a roadside garbage can and found the most thoroughly mixed and kneaded garbage I have ever seen. I suppose all great inventions spring from some such experience. The next morning, I washed the plastic bucket, put in two shirts, underwear, and socks, added hot water and detergent, and hung it by its rubber rope to the clothes pole, where it jiggled and danced crazily all day. That night, I rinsed the clothes in a stream, and you've never seen clothes so clean. Inside Rocinante, I strung a nylon line close to the window and hung the clothes to dry. From that time on, my clothing was washed on one day of driving and dried on the next. I even went overboard and washed sheets and pillowcases that way. So much for daintiness, but it didn't take care of hot baths. Not far outside of Bangor, I stopped at an auto court and rented a room. It wasn't expensive. The sign said, "Greatly reduced winter rates." It was immaculate. Everything was done in plastics. The floor, the curtain, tabletops of stainless, burnless plastic, lampshades of plastic. Only the bedding and the towels were of a natural material. I went to the small restaurant run in conjunction. It was all plastic, too. The table linen, the butter dish, the sugar and crackers were wrapped in cellophane. It was early evening, and I was the only customer. Even the waitress wore a sponge-off apron. She wasn't happy, but then she wasn't unhappy. She wasn't anything. But I don't believe anyone is a nothing. There has to be something inside, if only to keep the skin from collapsing. This vacant eye, listless hand, this damask cheek dusted like a donut with plastic powder, had to have a memory or a dream. On a chance, I asked, "How soon you going to Florida?" "Next week," she said listlessly. Then something stirred in that aching void. "Say, how do you know I'm going?"
"Read your mind, I guess."
She looked at my beard. "You with the show?"
"No."
"Then how do you mean, read my mind?"
"Maybe I guessed. Like it down there?"
"Oh, sure. I go every year. Lots of waitress jobs in the winter."
What do you do down there? I mean, for fun.
Nothing. Just fool around.
Do you fish or swim?
Not much. I just fool around. I don't like that sand. Makes me itch.
Make good money?
It's a cheap crowd.
Cheap?
I'd rather spend it on booze.
Then what?
Then tips. Just the same here with the summer people.
Cheap. Strange how one person can saturate a room with vitality, with excitement. Then there are others, and this dame was one of them, who can drain off energy and joy, can suck pleasure dry and get no sustenance from it. Such people spread a grayness in the air about them. I've been driving a long time, and perhaps my energy was low and my resistance down. She got me. I felt so blue and miserable, I wanted to crawl into a plastic cover and die. What a date she must be. What a lover. I tried to imagine that last and couldn't. For a moment, I considered giving her a $5 tip, but I knew what would happen. She wouldn't be glad. She'd just think I was crazy. I went back to my clean little room. I don't ever drink alone. It's not much fun, and I don't think I will until I'm an alcoholic. But this night, I got a bottle of vodka from my stores and took it to my cell. In the bathroom, two water tumblers were sealed in cellophane sacks with the words, "These glasses are sterilized for your protection." Across the toilet seat, a strip of paper bore the message, "This seat has been sterilized with ultraviolet light for your protection." Everyone was protecting me, and it was horrible. I tore the glasses from their covers. I violated the toilet seat with my foot. I poured half a tumbler of vodka and drank it, and then another. Then I lay deep in hot water in the tub, and I was utterly miserable. And nothing was good anywhere. Charlie caught it from me, but he is a gallant dog. He came into the bathroom, and that old fool played with the plastic bath mat like a puppy. What strength of character. What a friend. Then he rushed to the door and barked as though I were being invaded. And if it hadn't been for all that plastic, he might have succeeded. I remember an old Arab in North Africa, a man whose hands had never felt water. He gave me mint tea in a glass so coated with use that it was opaque, but he handed me companionship, and the tea was wonderful because of it. And without any protection, my teeth didn't fall out, nor did running sores develop. I began to formulate a new law describing the relationship of protection to despondency. A sad soul can kill you quicker, far quicker, than a germ. If Charlie hadn't shaken and bounced and said, I might have forgotten that every night he gets two dog biscuits and a walk to clear his head. I put on clean clothes and went out with him into the star-rattled night, and the aurora borealis was out. I've seen it only a few times in my life. It hung and moved with majesty in folds like an infinite traveler upstage in an infinite theater. In colors of rose and lavender and purple, it moved and pulsed against the night, and the frost-sharpened stars shone through it. What a thing to see at a time when I needed it so badly. I wondered for a moment whether I should grab that waitress and kick her behind out to look at it, but I didn't dare. She could make eternity and infinity melt and run out through your fingers. The air had a sweet burn of frost, and Charlie, moving ahead, saluted in detail a whole row of clipped privet, and he steamed as he went. When he came back, he was pleased and glad for me. I gave him three dog biscuits, rumpled up the sterile bed, and went out to sleep in Rocinante. It is not unlike me that in heading toward the west, I should travel east. That has always been my tendency. I was going to Deer Isle for a very good reason. My longtime friend and associate, Elizabeth Otis, has been going to Deer Isle every year. When she speaks of it, she gets an other world look in her eyes and becomes completely inarticulate. When I planned my trip, she said, "Of course you'll stop at Deer Isle."
"It's out of my way."
"Nonsense," she said in a tone I know very well. I gathered from her voice and manner that if I didn't go to Deer Isle, I had better never show my face in New York again. She then telephoned Miss Eleanor Brace, with whom she always stays, and that was that. I was committed. All I knew about Deer Isle was that there was nothing you could say about it, but if I didn't go, I was crazy. Also, Miss Brace was waiting for me. I got thoroughly lost in Bangor, what with traffic and trucks, horns blaring and lights changing. I vaguely remembered that I should be on U.S. Highway 1, and I found it and drove 10 miles in the wrong direction, back toward New York. I had been given written directions on how to go, detailed directions, but have you ever noticed that instructions from one who knows the country get you more lost than you are, even when they are accurate? I also got lost in Ellsworth, which I am told is impossible. Then the roads narrowed and the lumber trucks roared past me. I was lost almost all day, even though I found Blue Hill and Sedgwick. Late in the despairing afternoon, I stopped my truck and approached a majestic Maine state trooper. What a man he was. Granite as any quarried about Portland. A perfect model for some future equestrian statue. I wonder if future heroes will be carved in marble jeeps or patrol cars. "I seem to be lost, officer. I wonder if you could direct me."
"Where is it you want to go?"
"I'm trying to get to Deer Isle." He looked at me closely, and when he was satisfied that I wasn't joking, he swung on his hips and pointed across a small stretch of open water, and he didn't bother to speak.
"Is that it?"
He nodded from up to down and left his head down.
"Well, how do I get there?"
I have always heard that Maine people are rather taciturn, but for this candidate for Mount Rushmore to point twice in an afternoon was to be unbearably talkative. He swung his chin in a small arc in the direction I had been traveling. If the afternoon had not been advancing, I would have tried for another word from him, even if doomed to failure.
"Thank you,"
I said, and sounded to myself as though I rattled on forever. First, there was a very high iron bridge, as high-arched as a rainbow, and after a bit, a low stone bridge built in the shape of an S-curve, and I was on Deer Isle. My written direction said that I must take every road branch that turned right, and the word "every" was underlined. I climbed a hill and turned right into pine woods, and on a smaller road, and turned right on the very narrow road, and turned right again on wheel tracks on pine needles. It is so easy once you've been over it. I couldn't believe I would find the place, but in 100 yards, there was the great old house of Miss Eleanor Brace. And there she was to welcome me. I let Charlie out, and suddenly an angry streak of gray burned across the clearing in the pines and bucketed into the house. That was George. He didn't welcome me, and he particularly didn't welcome Charlie. I never did rightly see George, but his sulking presence was everywhere. For George is an old gray cat who has accumulated a hatred of people and things so intense that even hidden upstairs he communicates his prayer that you will go away. If the bomb should fall and wipe out every living thing except Miss Brace, George would be happy. That's the way he would design a world if it were up to him. And he could never know that Charlie's interest in him was purely courteous. If he did, he would be hurt in his misanthropy, for Charlie has no interest in cats whatever, even for chasing purposes. We didn't give George any trouble because for 2 nights we stayed in Rocinante. But I am told that when guests sleep in the house, George goes into the pine woods and watches from afar, grumbling his dissatisfaction and pouring out his dislike. Miss Brace admits that for the purposes of a cat, whatever they are, George is worthless. He isn't good company, he is not sympathetic, and he has little aesthetic value. "Perhaps he catches mice and rats," I suggested helpfully.
"Never."
said Miss Brace. Wouldn't think of it. And do you know something? George is a girl. I had to restrain Charlie because the unseen presence of George was everywhere. In a more enlightened day, when witches and familiars were better understood, George would have found his, or rather her, end in a bonfire, because if ever there was a familiar, an envoy of the devil, a consorter with evil spirits, George is it. One doesn't have to be sensitive to feel the strangeness of Deer Isle, and if people who've been going there for many years cannot describe it, what can I do after 2 days? It is an island that nestles like a suckling against the breast of Maine, but there are many of those. The sheltered, darkling water seems to suck up light, but I've seen that before. The pine woods rustle and the wind cries over open country that is like Dartmoor. Stonington, Deer Isle's chief town, does not look like an American town at all in place or in architecture. Its houses are layered down to the calm water of the bay. This town very closely resembles Lyme Regis on the coast of Dorset, and I would willingly bet that its founding settlers came from Dorset or Somerset or Cornwall. Maine speech is very like that in West Country England, the double vowels pronounced as they are in Anglo-Saxon, but the resemblance is doubly strong on Deer Isle. And the coastal people below the Bristol Channel are secret people, and perhaps magic people. There's aught behind their eyes, hidden away so deep that perhaps even they do not know they have it. And that same thing is so in Deer Islers. To put it plainly, this isle is like Avalon. It must disappear when you are not there. Or take, for example, the mystery of the coon cats, huge, tailless cats with gray coats barred with black, which is why they are called coon cats. They are wild, they live in the woods, and are very fierce. Once in a while, a native brings in a kitten and raises it, and it is a pleasure to him, almost an honor. But coon cats are rarely even approximately tame. You take a chance of being raked or bitten all the time. These cats are obviously of Manx origin, and even interbreeding with tame cats, they contribute taillessness. The story is that the great ancestors of the coon cats were brought by some ship's captain, and that they soon went wild. But I wonder where they get their size. They are twice as big as any Manx cat I ever saw. Could it be that they bred with bobcat or lynx? I don't know. Nobody knows. Down by the Stonington Harbor, the summer boats were being pulled up for storage. And not only here, but in other inlets nearby are very large lobster ponds crawling with those dark-shelled Maine lobsters from the dark water, which are the best lobsters in the world. Miss Brace ordered up 3, not more than 1.5 pounds, she said, and that night their excellence was demonstrated beyond a doubt. There are no lobsters like these, simply boiled with no fancy sauces, only melted butter and lemon. They have no equals anywhere. Even shipped or flown alive away from their dark homes, they lose something. At a wonderful store in Stonington, half hardware store and half ship's chandler, I bought a kerosene lamp with a tin reflector for Rosinante. I had the fear that I might somewhere run out of butane gas, and how would I read in bed then? I screwed the lamp bracket to the wall over my bed and trimmed the wick to make a golden butterfly of flame. And often on my trip I used it for warmth and color as well as light. It was exactly the same lamp that was in all the rooms at the ranch when I was a child. And no pleasanter light was ever designed, although old-timers say that whale oil makes a nicer flame. I have demonstrated that I can't describe Deer Isle. There is something about it that opens no door to words. But it stays with you afterward, and more than that, things you didn't know you saw come back to you after you've left. One thing I remember very clearly, it might have been caused by the season with the quality of light or the autumn clarity. Everything stood out separate from everything else. A rock, a rounded lump of sea-polished driftwood on a beach, a roofline. Each pine tree was itself and separate, even if it was a part of a forest. Drawing a very long bow of relationships, could I say that the people have the same quality? Surely I never met such ardent individuals. I would hate to try to force them to do anything they didn't want to do. I heard many stories about the isle. I remember it as isle and not island, and was given much taciturn advice. I will repeat only one admonishment from a native of Maine, and I will not put a name to that person for fear of reprisal. Don't ever ask directions of a Maine native, I was told. Why ever not? Somehow we think it's funny to misdirect people, and we don't smile when we do it, but we laugh inwardly. It is our nature. I wonder if that is true. I could never test it, because through my own efforts I am lost most of the time without any help from anyone. I have spoken with approval, even affection, of Rosinante, but not of the pickup truck on which the Campertop rode. It was a new model, with a powerful V6 engine. It had automatic transmission and an oversized generator to give me lights inside the cabin if I should need them. The cooling system was so loaded with antifreeze that it could have withstood polar weather. I believe that American-made automobiles for passengers are made to wear out, so they must be replaced. That is not so with trucks. A trucker requires many more thousands of miles of good service than a passenger car owner. He is not to be dazzled with trimming or fins or doodads, and he is not required by his status to buy a new model every year or so to maintain social face. Everything about my truck was made to last. Its frame was heavy, the metal rigid, the engine big and sturdy. Of course, I treated it well in matters of oil changes and greasing, and did not drive it to its limit or force it to do acrobatics required of sports cars. The cab was double-walled, and a good heater had been installed. When I returned after more than 10,000 miles, the engine was only well broken in. And it never failed or stuttered even once during the journey. I moved up the coast of Maine through Millbridge and Addison and Machias and Perry and South Robinson until there was no more coast. I never knew or had forgotten how much of Maine sticks up like a thumb into Canada with New Brunswick on the east. We know so little of our own geography. Why, Maine extends northward almost to the mouth of the St. Lawrence, and its upper border is perhaps 100 miles north of Quebec. And another thing I had conveniently forgotten was how incredibly huge America is. As I drove north through the little towns and the increasing forest rolling away to the horizon, the season changed quickly and out of all proportion. Perhaps it was my getting away from the steadying hand of the sea. And also, perhaps, I was getting very far north. The houses had a snow-beaten look, and many were crushed and deserted, driven to earth by the winters. Except in the towns, there was evidence of a population which had once lived here and farmed, had its being, and had then been driven out. The forests were marching back, and where farm wagons once had been, only the big logging trucks rumbled along. And the game had come back, too. Deer strayed on the roads, and there were marks of bear. There are customs, attitudes, myths and directions and changes that seem to be part of the structure of America. And I propose to discuss them as they were first thrust on my attention. While these discussions go on, you are to imagine me bowling along on some little road or pulled up behind a bridge, or cooking a big pot of lima beans and salt pork. And the first of these has to do with hunting. I could not have escaped hunting if I had wanted to, for open seasons spangle the autumn. We have inherited many attitudes from our recent ancestors who wrestled this continent as Jacob wrestled the angel, and the pioneers won. From them we take a belief that every American is a natural-born hunter. And every fall, a great number of men set out to prove that without talent, training, knowledge, or practice, they are dead shots with a rifle or shotgun. The results are horrid. From the moment I left Sag Harbor, the guns were booming at the migrating ducks, And as I drove in Maine, the rifle shots in the forest would have frightened off any number of redcoats so long as they didn't know what was happening. This is bound to get me a bad name as a sportsman, but let me say at once that I have nothing against the killing of animals. Something has to kill them, I suppose. In my youth, I often crawled miles on my belly through freezing wind for the pure glory of blasting a mud hen, which, even soaked in salt water, made poor eating. I don't greatly care for venison or bear or moose or elk except for the livers. The recipes, the herbs, the wine, the preparation that goes into a good venison dish would make an old shoe a gourmet's delight. If I were hungry, I would happily hunt anything that runs or crawls or flies, even relatives, and tear them down with my teeth. But it isn't hunger that drives millions of armed American males to forests and hills every autumn, as the high incidence of heart failure among the hunters will prove. Somehow the hunting process has to do with masculinity, but I don't quite know how. I know there are any number of good and efficient hunters who know what they are doing, but many more overweight gentlemen primed with whiskey and armed with high-powered rifles. They shoot at anything that moves or looks as though it might, and their success in killing one another may well prevent a population explosion. If the casualties were limited to their own kind, there would be no problem, but the slaughter of cows, pigs, farmers, dogs, and highway signs makes autumn a dangerous season in which to travel. A farmer in Upper New York State painted the word cow in big black letters on both sides of his white bossy, but the hunter shot it anyway. In Wisconsin, as I was driving through, a hunter shot his own guide between the shoulder blades. The coroner, questioning this Nimrod, asked, "Did you think he was a deer?" "Yes, sir, I did." "But you weren't sure he was a deer?" "Well, no, sir, I guess not." With the rolling barrage going on in Maine, of course I was afraid for myself. Four automobiles were hit on opening day, but mainly I was afraid for Charlie. I know that a poodle looks very like a buck deer to one of these hunters, and I had to find some way of protecting him. In Rocinante, there was a box of red Kleenex that someone had given me as a present. I wrapped Charlie's tail in red Kleenex and fastened it with rubber bands. Every morning, I renewed his flag, and he wore it all the way west while bullets whined and whistled around us. This is not intended to be funny. The radios warned against carrying a white handkerchief. Too many hunters seeing a flash of white have taken it for a tail of a running deer and cured a head cold with a single shot. But this legacy of the frontiersman is not a new thing. When I was a child on the ranch near Salinas, California, we had a Chinese cook who regularly made a modest good thing of it. On a ridge not far away, a sycamore log lay on its side supported by two of its broken branches. Lee's attention was drawn to this speckled fawn-colored chunk of wood by the bullet holes in it. He nailed a pair of horns to one end and then retired to his cabin until deer season was over. Then he harvested the lead from the old tree trunk. Some seasons he got 50 or 60 pounds of it. It wasn't a fortune, but it was wages. After a couple of years, when the tree was completely shot away, Lee replaced it with four gunny sacks of sand and the same antlers. Then it was even easier to harvest his crop. If he had put out 50 of them, it would have been a fortune. But Lee was a humble man who didn't care for mass production. Maine seemed to stretch on endlessly. I felt as Perry must have when he approached what he thought was the North Pole, but I wanted to see Aroostook County, the big northern county of Maine. There are three great potato-raising sections, Idaho, Suffolk County on Long Island, and Aroostook, Maine. Lots of people had talked of Aroostook County, but I had never met anyone who had actually been there. I had been told that the crop is harvested by Canucks from Canada who flood over the border at harvest time. My way went endlessly through forest country and past many lakes, not yet frozen. As often as I could, I chose the small wood roads, and they are not conducive to speed. The temperature lifted, and it rained endlessly, and the forests wept. Charlie never got dry and smelled as though he were mildewed. The sky was the color of wet gray aluminum, and there was no indication on the translucent shield where the sun might be, so I couldn't tell direction. On a curving road, I might have been traveling east or south or west instead of the north I wanted. That old fake about the moss growing on the north sides of trees lied to me when I was a Boy Scout. Moss grows on the shady side, and that may be any side. I determined to buy a compass in the next town, but there wasn't any next town on the road I was traveling. The darkness crept down and the rain drummed on the steel roof of the cab, and the windshield wipers sobbed their arcs. Tall, dark trees lined the road, crowding the gravel. It seemed hours since I had passed a car or a house or a store, for this was the country gone back to forest. A desolate loneliness settled on me, almost frightening loneliness. Charlie, wet and shivering, curled up in his corner of the seat and offered no companionship. I pulled in behind the approach to a concrete bridge, but couldn't find a level place on the sloping roadside. Even the cabin was dismal and damp. I turned the gas mantle high, lit the kerosene lamp, and lighted two burners of my stove to drive the loneliness away. The rain drummed on the metal roof. Nothing in my stock of foods looked edible. The darkness fell and the trees moved closer. Over the rain drums, I seemed to hear voices, as though a crowd of people muttered and mumbled off stage. Charlie was restless. He didn't bark an alarm, but he growled and whined uneasily, which is very unlike him, and he didn't eat his supper, and he left his water dish untouched. And that by a dog who drinks his weight in water every day and needs to because of the outgo. I succumbed utterly to my desolation. Made two peanut butter sandwiches and went to bed and wrote long letters home, passing my loneliness around. Then the rain stopped falling, and the trees dripped, and I helped to spawn a school of secret dangers. Oh, we can populate the dark with horrors, even we who think ourselves informed and sure, believing nothing we cannot measure or weigh. I knew beyond all doubt that the dark things crowding in on me either did not exist or were not dangerous to me, and still I was afraid. I thought how terrible the nights must have been in a time when men knew the things were there and were deadly. But no, that's wrong. If I knew they were there, I would have weapons against them, charms, prayers, some kind of alliance with forces equally strong but on my side. And knowing they were not there made me defenseless against them and perhaps more afraid. Long ago, I owned a little ranch in the Santa Cruz Mountains in California. In one place, a forest of giant madrona trees joined their tops over a true tarn, a black, spring-fed lake. If there is such a thing as a haunted place, that one was haunted, made so by dim light strained through the leaves and various tricks of perspective. I had working for me a Filipino man, a hill man, short and dark and silent, of the Maori people, perhaps. Once, thinking he must have come from a tribal system which recognizes the unseen as part of reality, I asked this man if he was not afraid of the haunted place, particularly at night. He said he was not afraid because years before a witch doctor gave him a charm against evil spirits. "Let me see that charm," I asked. "It's words," he said. "It's a word charm." "Can you say them to me?"
"Sure,"
he said, and he droned. "In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti." "What does it mean?" I asked. He raised his shoulders.
"I don't know," he said. "It's a charm against evil spirits, so I am not afraid of them."
I've dredged this conversation out of a strange-sounding Spanish, but there is no doubt of his charm, and it worked for him. Lying in my bed under the weeping night, I did my best to read to take my mind out of misery, but while my eyes moved on the lines, I listened to the night. On the edge of sleep, a new sound jerked me awake, the sound of footsteps, I thought, moving stealthily on gravel. On the bed beside me, I had a flashlight 2 feet long, made for coon hunters. It throws a powerful beam at least a mile. I got up from bed and lifted my 30-30 carbine from the wall and listened again near the door of Rosinante. And I heard the steps come closer. Then Charlie roared his warning, and I opened the door and sprayed the road with light. It was a man in boots and a yellow oilskin. The light pinned him still. "What do you want?" I called. He must have been startled. It took him a moment to answer. "I want to go home. I live up the road." And now I felt the whole silly thing, the ridiculous pattern that had piled up layer on layer. "Would you like a cup of coffee or a drink?"
"No, it's late. If you'll take that light out of my face, I'll get along."
I snapped off the light and he disappeared, but his voice in passing said,
"Come to think of it, what are you doing here?"
"Camping," I said. "Just camp for the night." And I went to sleep the moment I hit the bed. The sun was up when I awakened and the world was remade and shining. There are as many worlds as there are kinds of days, and as opal changes its colors and its fire to match the nature of a day, so do I. The night fears and loneliness were so far gone that I could hardly remember them. Even Rosinante, dirty and pine needle covered as she was, seemed to leap over the road with joy. Now there were open fields among the lakes and forests, fields with the crumbly, friable soil potatoes love. Trucks with flatbeds loaded with empty potato barrels moved on the roads, and the mechanical potato digger turned up long windrows of pale-skinned tubers. In Spanish, there is a word for which I can't find a counterword in English. It is the verb vacilar, present participle vacilando. It does not mean vacillating at all. If one is vacilando, he is going somewhere but doesn't greatly care whether or not he gets there, although he has direction. My friend Jack Wagner has often, in Mexico, assumed this state of being. Let us say we wanted to walk in the streets of Mexico City, but not at random. We would choose some article almost certain not to exist there and then diligently try to find it. I wanted to go to the roof tree of Maine to start my trip before turning west. It seemed to give the journey a design, and everything in the world must have a design or the human mind rejects it. But in addition, it must have purpose or the human conscience shies away from it. Maine was my design. Potatoes, my purpose. If I had not seen a single potato, my status as vacilador would not have been affected. As it turned out, I saw almost more potatoes than I needed to see. I saw mountains of potatoes, oceans, more potatoes than you would think the world's population could consume in 100 years. I've seen many migrant crop-picking people about the country, Hindus, Filipinos, Mexicans, Okies away from their states. Here in Maine, a great many were French Canadians who came over the border for the harvest season. It occurs to me that just as the Carthaginians hired mercenaries to do their fighting for them, we Americans bring in mercenaries to do our hard and humble work. I hope we may not be overwhelmed one day by peoples not too proud or too lazy or too soft to bend to the earth and pick up the things we eat. These Canucks were a hardy people. They traveled and camped by families and groups of families, perhaps even clans, men, women, boys, girls, and small children, too. Only the nurslings did not work at picking up the potatoes and placing them in the barrels. Americans drove the trucks and used a windlass and a kind of davit to pull the filled barrels aboard. Then they drove away to deposit the crop in the potato barns, with earth heaped high about their sides to prevent freezing. My knowledge of Canuck French derives from motion pictures, usually with Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald, and it consists largely of "By gar!" It's odd, but I didn't hear a single one of the potato pickers say "By gar!" And they must have seen the pictures and known what is right. The women and girls wore pants, usually of corduroy, and thick sweaters, and they covered their heads with bright-colored scarves to protect their hair from the dust that rises from the fields with the smallest wind. Most of these people traveled in big trucks covered with dark canvas tarpaulins, but there were some trailers and a few camper tops like Rosinante. At night, some slept in the trucks and trailers, but there were tents pitched in pleasant places, and the smells that came from their cooking fires indicated that they had not lost their French genius for making soup. Fortunately, the tents and trucks and two trailers were settled on the edge of a clear and lovely lake. I parked Rosinante about 95 yards away, but also on the lake's edge. Then I put on coffee to boil and brought out my garbage bucket laundry, which had been jouncing for 2 days, and rinsed the detergent out of the edge of the lake. Attitudes toward strangers crop up mysteriously. I was downwind from the camp, and the odor of their soup drifted to me. Those people might have been murderers, sadists, brutes, ugly, apish subhumans for all I knew, but I found myself thinking, what charming people. What flair, how beautiful they are, how I wish I knew them. And all based on the delicious smell of soup. In establishing contact with strange people, Charlie is my ambassador. I release him, and he drifts toward the objective, or rather to whatever the objective may be preparing for dinner. I retrieve him so that he will not be a nuisance to my neighbors. Et voilà! A child can do the same thing, but a dog is better. The incident came off as smoothly as one might expect of a tested and well-rehearsed script. I sent out my ambassador and drank a cup of coffee while I gave him time to operate. Then I strolled to the camp to relieve my neighbors of the inconvenience of my miserable cur. They were nice-looking people, a dozen of them, not counting children, three of the girls pretty and given to giggling, two of the wives buxom, and a third even buxomer with child, a patriarch, two brothers-in-law, and a couple of young men who were working toward being brothers-in-law. But the operating chieftain, with deference, of course, to the patriarch, was a fine-looking man of about 35, broad-shouldered and lithe, with the cream and berries complexion of a girl and crisp black curling hair. The dog had caused no trouble, he said. The truth was that they had remarked that he was a handsome dog. I, of course, found myself prejudiced in spite of his deficiencies being his owner, but the dog had one advantage over most dogs. He was born and raised in France. The group closed ranks. The three pretty girls giggled and were constantly smothered by the navy blue eye of the chieftain, backed by a hiss from the patriarch. Was that the truth? Where in France? In Bercy, on the outskirts of Paris. Did they know it? No, unfortunately, they had never been to the fatherland. I hoped they might remedy that. They should have known Charlie for a French national by his manners. They had observed my roulotte with admiration. It was simple but comfortable. If they found it convenient, I should be pleased to show it to them. I was very kind. It would give them pleasure. If the elevated tone indicates to you that it was carried on in French, you are wrong. The chieftain spoke a very pure and careful English. The one French word used was roulotte. The asides among themselves were in Canuck. My French is ridiculous, anyway. No, the elevated tone was part and parcel of the pageantry of establishing a rapport. I gathered Charlie to me. Might I expect them after their supper, which I smelled on the fire? They would be honored. I set my cabin in order, heated and ate a can of chili con carne, made sure the beer was cold, and even picked a bouquet of autumn leaves and put them in a milk bottle on the table. The roll of paper cups laid in for just such an occasion had got squashed flat by a flying dictionary my first day out, but I made coasters from folded paper towels. It's amazing what trouble you would go to for a party. Then Charlie barked them in, and I was host in my own house. Six people can squeeze in behind my table, and they did. Two others beside me stood up, and the back door was wreathed with children's faces.
They were very nice people, but quite formal. I opened beer for the big ones and pop for the outsiders. In due course, these people told me quite a bit about themselves. They came over the border every year for the potato harvest. With everyone working, it made a nice little pool against the winter.
Did they have any trouble with immigration people at the border?
Well, no. The rules seemed to relax during the harvest season, and besides, the way was smoothed by a contractor to whom they paid a small percentage of their pay. But they didn't really pay him. He collected directly from the farmers. I've known quite a few migrant people over the years, Okies and Mexican wetbacks, and the Negroes who move into New Jersey and Long Island. And wherever I've seen them, there has always been a contractor in the background to smooth the way for them for a consideration. Years ago, the farmers tried to draw more labor than they needed so that they could lower wages. This seems to be no longer true, for government agencies channel only as many laborers as are needed, and some kind of minimum wage is maintained. In other cases, the migrants have been driven to movement and seasonal work by poverty and terrible need. Surely my guests for the evening were neither mistreated nor driven. This clan, having put their own small farm to bed for the winter in the province of Quebec, came over the line to make a small nest egg. They even carried a little feeling of holiday with them, almost like the hops and strawberry pickers from London and the Midland cities of England. These were a hardy and self-sufficient people, quite capable of taking care of themselves. I opened more beer. After the night of desolate loneliness, I felt very good to be surrounded by warm and friendly but cautious people. I tapped an artesian well of good feeling and made a small speech in my pigeon type of French. It began, "Merci, dame. Je vous porte un cher souvenir de la belle France, en particulier du département de Charente." They looked startled but interested. Then John, the chieftain, slowly translated my speech into high school English and put it back into Canadian French. "Charon?" he asked. "Why Charon?" I leaned down and opened a compartment under my sink and lifted out a bottle of very old and reverend brandy brought along for weddings, frostbite, and heart attacks. John studied the label with the devout attention a good Christian might give the Holy Sacrament, and his words were reverent.
"Jesus Christ," he said.
"I forgot, Charon. That's where cognac is." Then he read the purported year of the bottle's nativity and softly repeated his first words. He passed the bottle to the patriarch in his corner, and the old man smiled so sweetly that for the first time I could see he lacked front teeth. The brother-in-law growled in his throat like a happy tomcat, and the pregnant ladies twittered like alouettes singing to the sun. I handed John a corkscrew while I laid out the crystal. 3 plastic coffee cups, a jelly glass, a shaving mug, and several wide-mouthed pill bottles. I emptied their capsules into a saucepan and rinsed out the odor of wheat germ with water from the tap. The cognac was very, very good, and from the first muttered "Santé," and the first clicking sip, you could feel the brotherhood of man growing until it filled Rocinante full, and the sisterhood also. They refused seconds, and I insisted, and the division of thirds was put on the basis that there wasn't enough to save. And with the few divided drops of that third, there came into Rocinante a triumphant human magic that can bless a house, or a truck for that matter. 9 people gathered in complete silence, and the 9 parts making a whole as surely as my arms and legs are part of me, separate and inseparable. Rocinante took on a glow it never quite lost. Such a fabric cannot be prolonged, and should not be. The patriarch gave some kind of signal. My guests squirmed out of their squeezed-up seats behind the table, and the adieux, as they should be, were short and formal. Then they went into the night, their way home lighted by the chieftain John carrying a tin kerosene lantern. They walked in silence among sleepy, stumbling children, and I never saw them again. But I like them. I didn't make down my bed because I wanted to start very early. I curled up behind a table and slept a little while until, in the dim false dawn, Charlie looked into my face and said, "Fit." While I heated my coffee, I made a little sign on cardboard and stuck it in the neck of the empty brandy bottle. Then, passing the sleeping camp, I stopped and stood the bottle where they would see it. The sign read, "Enfant